Okay, so here, again, we're, this is our time to make a biology class. We're just finishing up the concept topic of sequence alignment, of sequence assembly. I want to give a talk a little bit more about that today, before we move on to our next topic, which would be string similarity searching. But first of all, are there any questions about the homework? Any questions about the homework assignment? Questions? Yeah.
Very likely.
Right.
We need to find the
probability. So I want you to try to analyze the question. The question there about analyzing sequence probability. Say, what is the, I'm asking, what is the light size string that is large enough that it almost certainly occurs in a random sequence of size n? And a sequence that is short, but still just long enough that it is likely to be, almost likely, not very unlikely to occur by chance. It turns out doing those computations exactly right are actually fairly tricky. Okay? So I want you to think a little bit about how you can do it and get an idea of the ballpark for how you do it. Okay? So if you, the right way to do it, you would determine probabilities and confidence bounds and things like that. And, you know, I encourage you to start, you know, to try and play around with that. But there's some weird things about string statistics that aren't obvious unless you study them a little bit. But I would encourage you to think about it. You should get a good handle as to, you know, how big should it be till you start to expect something, you know, with a reasonable probability, and how big is enough that it's almost not going to exist by chance. And I encourage you to think about that, try to analyze it if necessary. You know, maybe do some experiments or something like that. If you can't do the analysis, you don't know enough probability. But just try to do as best you can with that. Okay? I expect different qualities of answers depending upon how good the probability skills are of the people in that group. Okay? Any questions? Okay? Any other questions about the homework? Okay. Are there any questions here about any people here who do not yet have partners? Who does not yet have a partner? If you do not yet have a partner, stand up and come to the board. Okay? Not just stand up, but stand up and come to the board. Okay? Let's do this quickly. Okay? Stand up either on the biology side or the computational side, depending upon who you are. Okay? So let's finish standing. Is this everything? Okay, we're allowed two computational people per group. I see two computational people and one biologist, right? Chemist is good enough. You guys are a group. So take each other's names right now and you are a group. Is there anybody else who is not matched up? Okay, so good. So now you should be able to start the homework and hopefully this will work out. Any questions? Two or three people is okay, but at least they have to be a heterogeneous group. They're not allowed to be three computational people or three biologists. Any questions? Okay? Good. Okay, so what I'd like to do now is just to finish talking a little bit about sequence assembly. We've talked about the basic theory of sequence assembly. We've talked about the spring out data structures you need in order to do shotgun assembly in a reasonable way. What I'd like to spend a few minutes talking about, which I started talking about a little bit at the end of class, just to sort of make the discussion complete, is to talk about some of the technology-dependent, messy kind of things that real assemblers have to worry about, okay, and that do occur in real sequencing projects, okay? Again, I mentioned last time that there's this problem of chimera detection, that certain fragments are, in fact, that you sequence up your sequencing machine will be, in fact, taking concatenations of two half fragments from random parts in the genome, and these cause big trouble in the assembly. So you have to try to identify those fragments and throw them out. You know, if you think about a project like Celera's, they had 26 million fragments. It's okay to throw out a few fragments if they're going to cause you trouble in assembling. But trying to identify which are the 1% of bad fragments is a tricky business. Okay, but that's something you have to do in order to make the assembler work. Ultimately, you have to do in the final phase a step that we would call multiple sequence alignment, where now that you've got, you know the rough order of the fragments, and you know that this is going to overlap this one, and this is going to overlap this one, and this is going to overlap this one. Ideally, you're going to get into a situation
where you have, as I mentioned, several fragments overlapping the same point, and trying to figure out what the sequence that is edged by several overlapping fragments, each of which has error, is being finding a sort of alignment of all of them, you know, of several sequences. Now today we're going to start looking at the problem of sequence comparison, which is overlapping pairs of sequences and trying to figure out how similar they are and where the differences are. The problem of overlapping multiple sequences simultaneously is a harder problem, okay? But, you know, especially in noisy sequences.
You know, in the sequences that you get from off the sequencing machine, there's only 2% error or something like that. Multiple sequence alignment isn't necessarily hard under those conditions because, you know, if it's an alignment, it's going to be pretty obvious. But you still have to do it, and you have to vote to identify what the real sequence is. You have to be careful to identify repeat regions, okay? You know, that in a genome is not a random string. There's going to be very similar sequences that are going to occur, and you're going to have to take special action to make sure your assembler does not get fooled by those. And the final sort of real-world complication that's very important in practice is incorporating other information, additional information about the sequence fragments, the reads that you have, okay, to help with the assembly. So probably the most important such information is that typically the fragments of people sequence, or in a good sequencing project, okay, you'll be sequencing not fragments of length 500, but the two ends of a fragment that's larger than that. Okay? Let's say that's about 10,000 bases. Or maybe about 2,000 bases. Okay? What's useful about that? Why is it a good idea to sequence both ends? If you only sequence 500 bases at a time, what might be useful to know about sequencing both ends of a fragment? Okay? Of a so-called clone. That might help you in assembling. Okay? Well, what it tells us is that if I know that this string of length 500 is the left side of this piece is about 1,000 bases long, and this is the other side, I know any assembling where this and this are a million bases apart is a wrong assembling. Okay? If I know where these fragments, which pairs of fragments are on similar clones, okay, are on the same clones, and how far apart they are, about, you know, roughly, okay, I can, if this is a small distance, then I can rule out a lot of, it helps me a lot in assembly, because I know that these two have to be close to each other. Does that make sense? Okay? So that knowing that two fragments in particular are going to be close to each other clearly helps constrain the assembly. But in order for that to help, you have to actually put it in the assembler. And the assembler has to take advantage of that information. Okay? Does everybody sort of see that? That's a useful thing. This is why assembly is not just shortest common superstring. Because here we know that this would be one of our strings, this is one of our other strings. It's sort of got a superstring with additional constraints, okay? Like knowing the approximate distance between certain pairs of fragments. Any questions? Okay? So these are sort of the complications that occur in real life. I wanted to talk just a little bit about some of the software that exists for doing a sequencing project. Okay? Again, I'm sorry the slide is not incredibly readable, but we can blame the Xerox machine for that. First thing you'd notice, I showed last class, at the end of last class, one of these gels, one of the actual electrophoresis gels that you use in a sequencing machine to identify the pattern of bases And you saw that there were a lot of wavy lines in there corresponding to defects on the gel. You saw that at certain one end of the gel that the fragments were very close together, and at the other end they were very far apart. You need a non-trivial piece of software to interpret the results of the gel, to take one of those patterns of bands and determine AC, GT, TT, GGG from that. And for a long time, the standard, the most famous program for that was something called SPRED by a guy named Phil Green, who's a prominent computational biologist. And he wrote a very good base calling program. And what was most impressive about his base calling program is the people who sold sequencing machines gave a program with their sequencing machine. Okay, and his program was much better than the one the company was suggesting people use. Okay? And I don't really want to go too much into the algorithms that Fred used. Okay, it's, you know, to an algorithms person, it's sort of like hacks and tricks and things like that, more than it's a, you know, really fundamentally clean algorithm problem. But among the things that his program did that's important is that at every base, it didn't just give a letter with what it thought it was. It also gave a quality score. So you could, if you think about it, by doing these alignments, it's not just that if we have quality scores, it's not just a problem of saying, well, I've got three A's and a C, therefore I'll vote that's an A. If I have a quality score, how much does the gel reader trust that letter? It can help us make better decisions in overlap detection and in the final assembly. Okay? So doing that kind of stuff right is an important part of reading the gels. Any questions? That should be, I think, obvious. Okay? So the world of sequence assembly went through what I will say is two generations of assemblers, at least the way I would see the world. These programs that take the fragments and overlap them to produce the final assembly. The first generation were for relatively small projects, things that were about 50,000 bases, 100,000 bases, sequencing viruses, sequencing a contig, a piece, you know, the biggest piece you could hope to amplify in a bacteria or something like that. So small size projects, there were a generation of assemblers that are probably about 10 years old now to do these kind of projects. One of them is what you're playing around with on the homework, this CAP2 assembler, okay? And if you look at that program, it doesn't ask you about clone constraints. It doesn't say, are two pairs of fragments on the same side? Because the technology for such projects didn't support it. You didn't need that, okay? Instead, it basically told you, give me the reads from your sequencing machine, okay? Find the shortest common superstring. And it did some tricks to, in overlapping, trying to decide if one fragment overlapped another. It incorporated some knowledge about what kind of mistakes sequencing machines typically made. So there was a certain amount of trickery, and if you read the comments in that program, you'll see that there's some questions about how it tries to compare sequences to cut off bad regions, identify bad regions. It's a standard problem that if you have a long sequencing read, it gets less accurate after about 500 bases because the fragments start to get very close together or they run off the gel, okay? So it knew not to trust them as much, okay? That's sort of the first generation of assemblers. Then there was another even more famous assembler called FRAP, which was written by the same guy who wrote FRED, okay? That's why they both begin PH, okay? Okay, and the guy's name was Phil, so that may be why they both begin with PH. But so FRAP was a fairly widely used assembler, and what his assembler did is he incorporated his quality scores. He was sort of saying, well, if you used my gel reader, you would be able to take advantage of quality scores, and this would help you build better assemblies. Okay, and so this program did that, and a lot of other tricks, which if you're interested about, you can read on the slides. Okay, but to try to engineer a good assembler. And engineering a good assembler is engineering at some point. Okay. Any questions? The second generation of assemblers Okay? Well, at least how I will determine.
Started coming out around 1995 or so, when you started sequencing, some people got brave enough to shotgun sequence bacterial-sized genomes, genomes that were a million bases long or more.
And to do that, you start needing the fancy data structures we talked about in class. Because for something that is small, you know, you have 1,000 fragments, you can compare all 1,000 pairs of fragments. But you can't compare all million pairs of fragments without running into trouble. So the newer generation of assemblers, basically known, I would say that they're called basically the Tiger assembler and the Celera assembler.
These are sort of assemblers that were built by big sequencing groups, basically designed for their own custom project that would incorporate their own weird technology-dependent constraints. But they were designed to be very, very big. Okay, and they had to use the smart data structures, and they had to use other tricks like clone pairs and things like that. Okay? Any questions?
Okay. And again, at this point, when you're working with projects that are, you know, involving millions of bases, you have to make sure they run in linear time, or else it's hopeless. You know, you're not going to be able to do something like that efficiently. So these kind of algorithms typically work as follows. Basically, they do the assembly in a way where they look for which pair, they sort of do a greedy-like assembly at first. They'll look for all pairs of fragments that overlap by enough that they really trust it. Okay? And after this phase of assembly, to build up unity, what they would call, they have a lot of small assemblies, but assemblies they really trust. Now they would like to put these small pieces of assemblies together, okay, into a larger assembly. And here's where they use the notion that a large fraction of the fragments they sequence, they sequence both ends. If you have small assemblies that you trust, and if you have the identity of two fragments, two things that belong to different unitaries or different clusters, but they contain elements in the left and right ends of a particular clone, you know these two are very close to each other. Okay? And that might help you now fill in other fragments that you didn't feel brave enough to trust right now. Okay? So there's sort of an iterative notion where at some point you look for just fragment overlaps. And at some point you use the structure of knowing that one fragment and two fragments are on the same clone, okay, to try to order these clusters and then fill in more and more information. And gradually you put in less and less overlaps that you're less and less certain of. But maybe now there's more supporting evidence because they lie on the same clone or something like that. Okay? So this is where the engineering and the art of building a good assembler goes in. Okay? And exploiting the fact that every clone is sequenced both the left end and the right end is important to overcome this problem we have with the Landers-Waterman equation. With this problem, there are going to be lots of gaps in a sequencing project, unless you have a humongous coverage. Well, first of all, having the double-ended clone information helps you bridge gaps, because it lets you know, still, yeah, I don't have anything that covers the gap between here and here. But I do know that they're next to each other because they contain representatives of different endpoints. Okay, clones with different endpoints. In addition, so I can now put my sort of clusters together on the genome and line them in the right shape, right order. Plus, there really are at the end a gaps in my assembly. I know where the interesting gaps are. And if I now know that I would really like to stay in the gap between this end and this end, I can find a particular clone, a particular DNA sequence of 10 kilobases that contain those two ends, and then sequence that as a separate project to help span the gap. So having the double end, the iteration on both ends of each clone. Okay, I can identify a small number of clones that are worth sequencing entirely,
if that will help you span the final gap. Okay, so this strategy also gives you a way to help close gaps at the end. Any questions? Okay. So this is the kind of tricks that at some level you have to do to really do a full genome assembly.
So
I want to say a couple of other things about the final assembly of the human genome.
Again, I told you that there were two different groups, the public consortium and Celera, that both announced their sequence at the end of the same at the same day by sort of agreement. Okay, their assemblies were quite different, different in certain ways, and their sequencing strategies were different, and the groups continued to fight with each other about who did a better job. Okay, but what was maybe more interesting to me, and a couple of interesting things about it. One thing that's interesting is the public consortium, being a public consortium, stuck all of its data in GenBank as it sequenced it. Celera, being a private corporation, okay, trying to get proprietary information, took all the data that the public people had used and used that to help its assembly. They had their own sequencing data, but they said we could use our data and we can combine it with the public data. So we can, you know, we need to get a lot of coverage. We need to get an overlap of 30 or something, a coverage of 30. Maybe the public consortium will get a coverage of 10 and we'll buy a coverage of 20. And if we can steal their data, that's good. Okay? So they were very happy about this. The public consortium was not so happy about this, but they wanted to make the data public. The thing that I think was kind of interesting was that Celera did not trust the assembly of the public consortium. So the public consortium would put in the database, oh, here is an assembly of 100,000 bases. For Celera's assembler, they were working with small pieces of data, you know, fragments of size 500 or so, in order to use the public consortium's data. What they did was write a program to artificially spread the assembled data that the consortium had put together to create small reads, simulated reads, and then stuff that into its pipeline to analyze more, so it wouldn't be fooled by the public's assembly if they made mistakes. Okay? So it's something that's their problem of creating simulated reads is very similar to something that you're doing on the homework, okay, for testing your quality assembler. You're building simulated reads from some sequence. Okay? Another thing that is kind of interesting about the Celera assembly that that I know is the question about sequencing the genome that everyone always asks was whose DNA was it that was sequenced? Okay? And that, you know, what person had the honor of having their DNA sequenced? And Celera was run by a company, their big man was Craig Venter. Okay? He made it a point, of course, to make sure that his DNA was the one that was sequenced, just so he could be famous. But what's maybe more interesting than that is it wasn't exclusively one person's DNA. In order to get the maximum amount of information from the sequencing project, what Celera did, and I think it was a very clever idea, was that they may have used, let's say, 70% of Craig Venter's DNA, and then the rest of it was DNA from four or five people from widely divergent ethnic groups. Okay? Now, what was the strategy behind that? Why is that a good idea? Okay? Well, first of all, because all people from different ethnic groups are human, there is a large similarity between, you know, their different genomes. So it really doesn't make that much difference in the assembly. It doesn't make the assembly any harder, really. Because any two people differ in only one out of every 1,000 bases, the sequencing error is much less than that, okay? And so you can hope that you can certainly still do the assembly and everything's going to be fine. But you also get a lot more information about the human condition by doing the experiment with mixed people. Why is that? Because one of the things, once you sequence the human genome and you know how to make a person, the next thing that's going to be interesting is what makes people different from each other. We know they're the same because they basically have the same genome, the same proteins, but these differences start to become important when you want to analyze variation. And so, in the act, after they produce their assemblies, Celera, they can also now say, well, what fragments differ in one position? Okay?
And so you can see that in certain places, let's say the the Asian person or whoever it is, okay, there can only differ from trade vendors in some position. Okay? And that may or may not have been a medically different or interesting difference. You know. So the goal is trying to identify what the variation is. The difference between people, okay, is an important part of that experiment. And you get that somehow, at least some of that for free, by sequencing different people. Okay? Any questions about that?
So you didn't sequence five people separately. They sequenced
fragments, let's say 70% of which came from Craig Venter, okay? 10% came from somebody of ethnic group A, 10% came from ethnic group B, okay? And then assembled everything together, but they knew the identity of each fragment. They kept the record for each fragment. Who did it come from? Okay? And so now they can figure out, well, you know, who is, you know, what are the differences between Craig Venter and somebody else? Okay? So maybe this base change causes you to want to form a company to do DNA sequencing. If you have that base that causes you to want to do that, that would be one that would be present in Craig Venter, but not in somebody else. Yeah. No, so I don't know what the coverage level is. So there's a question of when you see a variance, is it a SNP, okay, meaning a single nucleotide polymorphism, a difference, okay, or is it a sequencing error? That's, I think, what you're really getting at. And the assumption is that they thought their experiment out well enough that they could get a certain amount of SNP information, okay, from this. Yeah. So what is the gain of assembling them together rather than assembling them separately? Okay, is that what the question is? Right. I'm not sure I'm understanding the question. Yes. Right. Yeah.
So
well, the assumption is that you need a high coverage to cover gaps. I guess the way I think I'd answer the question that you're having is that if you think about what the probability distribution of coverage is, as you walk along the genome from left to right, if you did this random shotgun assembly, okay, what's going to happen is certain places are going to get covered by a lot, some places will be covered by a relatively small number of fragments, right? So just by random chance, if we have a coverage of 30, every base should be covered by 30 fragments. But because of probability, sometimes you're going to get a lot, some places are going to get sequenced by more, some will get sequenced by less. You need the high coverage to ensure that every place gets covered by at least two or three fragments. Okay? So that's why you need all the sequences and fragments together in the assembler. Now, once you have that, in places where you have high enough coverage, now maybe in those regions you can hope to identify some SNP information. Okay? So then you can try to do some ethnic group analysis. But at the place in the genome that you've covered by the least, it may have only been Craig Venter, or only been the member of minority group B that had a fragment there. Okay? So you couldn't necessarily, you were interested, first of all, getting a representative human genome. The question of mapping the SNPs is a separate project, a very important project, but a separate project. Yes?
We have the full outline of one genome,
Right, so the question now is, once you have a representative genome, now is it easier to sequence the next person
Let's say you say, hey, I have $10 million, I want my genome sequenced too. Is it easier? The answer is yes. Because somehow, any fragment that you have, if we sequence a fragment of your DNA of 500 bases, we could probably match it with vendor's genome, with the Celera genome or the public consortium, and see where it fits. So in fact, you don't need the level of coverage as you would need before. Okay, you know roughly where it is. And so by sampling, let's say we only sequence your genome at one times coverage, what we would expect is that about, two-thirds of your of the bases, distinct bases, would have been sequenced at least once. We can align those fragments to the non-human sequence, and you'll know where those fragments are. So sequencing the first person is hard. The second, third, fourth, fifth person is easy. The goal is, but still expensive. The goal is to produce technologies where ultimately you can be sequenced for $100, in your doctor's office. Okay? And that's really somehow the technology for doing that does not yet exist. But in fact, is what drives some of the technologies we'll talk about later. We talk about microarrays. One of the original visions of microarrays is essentially to do that. Or at least try to do that, partially, for important genes. Any questions? Okay. So that's sort of the situation about genome sequencing. Basically, we're now to the point where, something like 100 different freestanding species have been sequenced, okay? Meaning at the bacterial level or above. There's probably been 50 or 60 bacteria that have been sequenced. There have been plants, there have been fungi, there have been mammals, man has been sequenced, dog has been sequenced, actually Craig Bettner's poodle, okay? Mouse has been sequenced, a lot of other species have been sequenced. It's not to the point where every animal has been sequenced, and that will not be the case for a long time, but the number of species, of higher organisms that get sequenced has been growing, and growing pretty rapidly, okay? Which now means the question of analyzing the sequence is now more important than getting it, okay? Any questions? So what I'd like to do at this point is shift gears a little bit to go away from the question of how do we get DNA genome sequences, but what do we do with them? And that's really what's going to try to drive what we're going to be doing most of the next rest of the semester. Any questions? Okay, good. So what I'd like to start off by talking about is spend the next several lectures talking about string comparison. Okay, so the fundamental thing that you want to do with, now that you've got all this DNA sequence sitting in databases, the fundamental thing that you want to do with it is search it for patterns and analyze it for patterns. And the most important sort of basic technology for analyzing string DNA sequences is string comparison. You want to know, and there are a bunch of different sort of string comparison problems that you might care about, okay? There's string comparison problems that come up in applications outside of biology. For example, anyone who goes into an internet search engine, you're magically typing a query, and out comes all the documents that have it. Somehow Google is doing a tremendous amount of string comparison, okay, or text comparison or pattern matching very, very rapidly, okay? Certainly when you look something up in a text editor, you want to say, where does schema occur in my document, okay? You have to do a certain amount of string searching. So string searching and string comparison is an important problem outside of biology. In biology, it's extremely important, as you'd like to know, for example, here is a gene. What species have this gene in it? Okay? Is there a string that represents this DNA sequence that is in some place that is some other species? That's really asking, is this sequence, does it roughly occur in another sequence? Okay, so you have the problems of substring searching. Is this string in another string? Okay, approximately, roughly, and things like that. So we're going to spend the next several classes talking about string comparison. And today we're going to talk about exact string matching. Okay, namely string matching without errors. And you're only going to accept a match if it represents an exact matching of the string or substring. This is what happens in Google. When you type in Skiena, S-K-I-E-N-A, you don't get the matches to people who misspelled my name. Okay? Sometimes it's fun to type in your name in Google misspelled and see if they find anything. Okay, on that. Okay? But we're not going to worry about exact match errors. We're only going to worry about exact match string matching today. And then starting next class, I believe, we'll start to get into algorithms for doing approximate matching. And eventually, algorithms for approximate matching on very DNA-specific problems. Okay, so that's sort of the evolution of what we're going to be talking about. Any questions? So when we talk about exact string matching problems, I will break the problem of exact string matching into three different classes of problems, okay, some of which we already know how to solve. One situation is what I would call the fixed text variable pattern problem. Okay? Let's say that you want to build a program for looking things up in the Bible. Okay? The Bible doesn't change, but what people want to look up in it changes. Okay? So the Bible is a huge string. You sometimes like to look up patterns, you know, where does Jesus occur in the Bible? Okay? And you would like to be able to do some processing of the text so as to make it very, very easy to find arbitrary patterns. Okay? So here the text is fixed, the pattern changes. The Bible is a good example, or the human genome. Just stop and think about it. You know, once you sequence Fred Bender's genome or the human genome, okay, it's now sitting in a database. You may repeatedly want to ask questions of it. That sequence is 3 billion bases long. If you can build a structure to make it fast to answer queries in that fixed string, you're in business. Okay, it's a useful thing to do. So that problem we've actually already discussed in some sense how you might solve it. We talked about suffix trees. A suffix tree or a suffix array is something we spend a certain amount of time analyzing a complicated text, a long text. Okay? Build a structure so that we can perform queries quickly. In the case of suffix trees, once you've built this, the big query, the big structure on the human genome, the question of here's a 20-character sequence, does it occur in the genome, can be answered by doing 20 comparisons, even though the genome is billions of bases long. Okay? So that is a problem we've looked at and already sort of analyzed. Any questions? Okay. A second problem that occurs, okay, is where you have a variable text but fixed patterns. Okay. So let's say that you want to analyze a news feed, okay, to see if anyone uses any dirty words. Okay. You know, let's say you're a censor, and when everybody uses a dirty word, you want to sort of yell at them. Okay. So you can imagine a world where you have a list of dirty words, okay, maybe a long list, okay? But you have text that's coming by. You want to spend some time, the list of dirty words isn't going to change, okay? But the text is going to change. Every day there's a new TV show, okay, a new text stream that's coming out. You want to build something that will quickly, where you can do a lot of work analyzing the patterns so as to make the testing the question, does any of these patterns exist in the text? Be very fast as we walk through the text. We could take the number of patterns, and for every pattern, run it through the text individually. But that's wasteful if you have a lot of patterns and you're analyzing the text. You know, then the patterns don't change. We can build a structure on the patterns, okay, and thus fix the patterns and vary the text. Okay? In biology, biological terms, this actually does have meaning. Okay, it's true that biologists get interested in motifs. There's certain substrings that are particularly interesting to them. Let's say binding sites for a particular, you know, for a particular protein. And it could very well be that a biologist is sitting there monitoring GenBank as people put in more and more sequences, asking, gee, if anybody ever puts in a sequence that contains C A T T T T T T T T T T T T T, send me mail. Okay, they might have a list of 100 promoter, you know, promoter sequences or binding sites that they're interested in. Okay, so this is a problem of biological interest as well. Okay, any questions? The final problem
is the one that you have seen in your text editor, and probably the most familiar of the string matching problems, is what I will call variable text and variable patterns. Someone gives you a string, someone gives you a pattern. You're only going to search this text once, or twice, or three times, so it doesn't pay to build a complicated index for it. Okay? So let's say, like, when you're looking something up in, you know, in a particular document you wrote, doesn't, unless it's, you're going to be really going to the document many, many times, it doesn't pay to build an index. Okay? So standard strings, variable text, variable pattern matching. Okay? That's the kind of thing that the order MN brute force search algorithm that we talked about is typically used for. Take the text, align the pattern against it. If you don't find it, move it over, move it over, move it over. Okay? That's the problem we're trying to solve before using that algorithm. Any questions? So, the problem of variable text, variable patterns is probably the most important one, okay, in non-biology applications, and the one that's been studied the most. In some sense, we already know how to solve this problem efficiently, okay? We know that if I give you a string and you build a suffix tree, you can build a suffix tree in linear time, right, in the size of the string. You can then search it for a pattern by walking down that thing. If we're just counting in the big O notation, there is no difference between an algorithm that would search for a new pattern and a new text could be done in order n plus m by spending order n time building the suffix tree, then order m time walking it down. That's linear in the pattern and linear in the text. Asymptotically, you can't hope to do any better than that. So if you want, that in some sense solves the problem of variable text and variable patterns. Okay? Any questions about that? Does everybody sort of see that? That, you know, in some sense this problem is asymptotically now dispatched. The trouble is that building a suffix tree is a complicated thing to do. Okay? Whereas that brute force algorithm was easy to program. Okay? So what I'd like to do is spend a little bit of time talking about efficient, easy-to-program algorithms for doing variable text, variable pattern exact matching. Okay? Just because it's sort of something people should know about. Okay? And then we'll talk about inexact matching next class. Any questions? Okay? Okay, so the question is that suppose I want to use a suffix tree. What if? How much time does it take to build a suffix tree? To build a suffix tree incrementally. So what I think what he's thinking is, okay, the suffix tree thing is good. I'm sitting in a text editor typing in text. Wouldn't it be nice if I could build my suffix tree and extend it automatically for every character that I insert? If I type in, this is a dime for all good men to come to the... that my tree gets built and grows incrementally. The answer is, if you're doing your insertions to the string, all at the end, growing it from left to right, you can efficiently maintain a suffix tree. You'll search in a partial suffix tree, and then as the string grows, you can continue to, you can update the suffix tree and continue to grow on it. So if you look at the algorithms for constructing suffix trees, which I didn't talk about, they work in that incremental way. At least one of them does. So you can, in fact, build a suffix tree incrementally. What you can't do very well, though, is to modify the middle of your string and then rebuild the suffix tree. So suffix trees are not good things for dynamically changing documents. Okay, they require a lot of work to maintain. So you're sitting in a in your text editor, and suddenly you realize you misspelled something in the middle. You would have to basically rebuild the whole suffix tree or do something very hideous to try to fix it up. Okay, so for our purposes, we'll think of suffix trees as best being for static structures. Okay, any questions? Okay, good. So let's look at the problem of exact string matching, okay? And just get a feeling for some of the algorithms. Okay, how many people here know the KNT algorithm, Knuth-Morris-Pratt? How many people are familiar with that?
Small number of people. How many of you are familiar with the Boyer-Moore algorithm? Small number of people. Okay, so if you're not familiar with it, that's good,
because I'm going to talk about them briefly. Okay? I just wanted to make sure of that beforehand. The standard string algorithm, the good linear time string matching algorithms, can be thought of as basically being modifications of the brute force algorithm, okay, in such a way that we can guarantee that we get, that they don't take quadratic time, okay? So what was the brute force search algorithm? The one that took order mn time. We started out, we had our text of length n, we had a pattern of length n, we stuck the pattern at the leftmost position of it, said, do you match, do you match, do you match, found the first point of mismatch, then slid the pattern over by one position, okay, and repeated this experiment, match, 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 okay, oops, it mismatched, slide the pattern over by one position, and repeat. In the worst case, that would take order mn time, because at each of the n positions in the text, we might spend m matches before we, m minus one characters on the pattern might match before we find the mismatch in the last position. Okay? And the question is there a way that we can do something smarter than pure brute force in doing that string alignment? Okay? So let's look at this particular example here. Here I've got a pattern, A, B, C, D, A, B, C, E. And my text is A, B, C, D, A, B, C, D. Okay? I start up trying to say, gee, does this pattern match the text here? And as you notice, so far I've matched it mismatched in the last position. My question is, does everybody see that? That otherwise it matched perfectly. If I was doing the naive Brot algorithm, here's where I discover that there is a mismatch. And in a naive algorithm, I'm now going to slide my pattern over by one position. Okay, and start again. My question is, can I do anything smarter than that? Okay? Is there any reason why, based on doing my analysis here, match, 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 mismatch, that I might be able to avoid sliding the pattern one cap position, but might be able to slide it more? Okay, yeah?
Slide it like in the next
E is found. Okay? Slide until the next E is found. A is found. Okay?
Till that point you won't get the mass for the point.
So what do I know at this point here? It's a question of what knowledge do I have at this point in my algorithm? Again, I matched, I slid, and I mismatched over here. What do I know? I know more than just the fact that the pattern doesn't exist. I know that the pattern doesn't exist, but it does exist for all the characters up to the point of the mismatch, right? I know something about this text, because I've already spent some hard-earned comparisons. Is this the same, this the same, this the same? To determine that they are the same. Okay? And the question is, now can I slide it over? Okay? And it should be the case that if I know that my previous characters were A, B, C, D, A, B, C, D, if I knew that there was a matchup to here, I know that sliding the character pattern one position can't possibly succeed. Why is that? Because that A is going to match that B, okay, and mismatch that B. So it can't do me any good to misslide by one position. Can it do any good to slide by two positions? No. Can it do any good to slide by three positions? Okay. Well, now what do I know? I've got A, B, I guess three positions is A, D. On the other hand, if I slide it by three positions, okay, by four positions, then in fact there's a chance it's going to match, because I know that the prefix of the pattern matches the suffix of the text that I have already matched. Does everybody sort of agree with that? Okay? So if I analyze my pattern, okay, I can in principle determine, if I spend a lot of time analyzing my pattern, I can determine how many positions I am allowed to slide the pattern on a mismatch at every single position.
Okay? And if I can do this analysis, it can help speed up my searching. Any questions about this? Okay. And we'll sort of see the intuition of what we'd like to try. Okay? Any questions? Okay?
So our goal is going to be to take advantage of the fact that what we already know about the match that so far failed, the last match to fail, to help us start searching from where it counts. Okay? And this basic idea is the thing at heart of the next two string algorithms. Any questions? Okay? So, the one that most directly implements this kind of an idea is something called the Knuth-Morris-Pratt algorithm, okay, or KMP for short. And what that's going to do is analyze the pattern and build, so here's the input pattern. It's going to spend a lot of time analyzing that pattern, or not a lot of time, but spend whatever time it needs to analyze that pattern to build a table that tells us that if we fail at the ith position, this is how many spaces you should slide the character over, the pattern over. Okay? Before, the naive algorithm basically said slide it over by zero, well, that's the fail function is the number of places we'll slide it over is the failure function plus one. The naive algorithm can be thought of as using a failure function where all these entries in the table are zero. Instead, what we're going to do is analyze the pattern to build up more, ideally try to determine the largest amount of shift that we can comfortably make for the pattern, knowing we're not going to miss anything. Okay? Any questions? What might be such a criteria for the failure function? There are lots of variations of this basic algorithm, so I don't want to get into the details of any particular failure function too deeply. But we sort of hit that idea before, that what we really want to know, it has something to do with the length of the longest prefix of the pattern, which can be a suffix up to this point. Remember, what was the criteria that we used to decide that we could slide this thing over four positions and it might match? The reason is we want to now know what is the longest prefix of the pattern we have seen, such that it will match the suffix of that pattern. Okay? That's sort of what the idea that we were using here. Okay? The reason why we knew that four positions was the right way amount to slide it was because the first three characters of this pattern match the last three characters of, the first three characters of the text match the last three characters of the text. The first three characters of the pattern up to here match the last three characters of the pattern up to here. Why not four? A, B, C, D, A, B, C, E. The text is what is being given. That we're not analyzing very carefully. The pattern is what we're building our table from in advance. Right? And we live in a world where patterns are to be thought of as short, and texts can be thought of as long. Right? So what you really want to do is to take the pattern and analyze the pattern to build up the table to help you search the text. And that's really what we're doing. We're building our analysis on the pattern only to build a table telling us how much of a shift we're allowed to do. Yeah? Well, the question is, can we adversely give a pattern that will shift by one always? And I'm going to claim the answer to that is no. Okay? Or you could adversely give a pattern that will shift by one always. But if so, that means that when you have a mismatch that is long, you will be... I don't glibly believe what you're saying. Okay? So let's look at the example here. In fact, saying that the algorithm is linear is a proof that bad things can't happen. Okay? And proving that is a subtle thing that I'm not going to do. Okay? Here, because of time and all this kind of stuff. But basically, your argument is that bad things might still happen, Okay, and I will claim that there is a proof that bad things will not happen. Okay? And let's see if we can get some intuition as to why that might be. So, here, let's look at what happens if we try to match this pattern A, B, A, B, A, B, A, C, A, against the string I constructed. Okay, we have here a failure function. We have here an input string. The failure function is built on the pattern. What is going to happen? Okay, we match A, B. The next character there is a mismatch. So what do we now know? We now know that AB is a, that it differs here. We know that sliding the pattern one place is not good enough. I'm not sure if my failure function here is right, so let's not worry too much about that. But let's think about logically what we can do. We know that we have matched AB. It is hopeless to match starting from A here. The failure function tells us we can slide over and start trying to match again the pattern AB here. Okay? Again, there's a mismatch. It tells us we can slide it over by one. We know that this is not a B. We can slide it over by one. Okay? We now have an A. It's not going to match. We slide it over by one. Here we have a situation where there is a lot of match. AB, 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 AC. Okay? We now have a mismatch, okay? And at least on some level, okay, this now tells, you know, depending upon what we know about the string and the pattern, we can now make a decision to slide the patterns further, okay? Based on the presence of the C or not. Okay? Again, I don't want to address this example too closely. But the basic intuition is that sometimes when there is a mismatch, we can jump by a lot, okay? And one of two things is going to happen. If we jump by a lot, what does that mean? That means that we had a match of a long character and we slid a lot of characters and we ended up sliding the pattern a lot. If we mismatch early, saying, gee, this doesn't match, doesn't match, doesn't match, then we didn't spend very much time at any particular comparison, right? So one of two things is going to happen in principle for us. If we get a small, you know, if we have a lot of early mismatches, we're going to fail quickly that the cost is going to be linear because we're only doing one comparison per test. If we have a mismatch after a long thing, okay, we can hope that we might slide the pattern a lot, okay, and that would give us a better, you know, that would also save us time. So we might be able to exploit all that we know about the pattern to help tell us to slide much. Okay? Any questions? Okay? So a careful analysis of this, which is not something that I want to do here, okay, basically using something called amortized analysis, which is, if you know about algorithm analysis, maybe you know about, and if you don't, I don't want to tell you about. The basic idea of amortized analysis is basically we're keeping track of, you know, that no real bad situation can happen, okay? That we every time we do a comparison, something good is going to basically happen, okay? Either we're going to move forward in the text by one because we had a mismatch, or we will have had a successful match, matching a pattern character with a text character, we move forward in the pattern. And that by counting, you know, basically we'll show that the number of backwards moves or bad things that happen is bounded by the, you know, can be bounded by the cost of the length of the pattern and the length of the text. Okay? So in the worst case, bad things can happen. Okay? But it's a little bit complicated to prove this. And if you look at a good algorithm book, you'll see a proof of the correctness of this algorithm. Or if you look at Gusfield's book, you'll see several proofs of several variations of this algorithm. Some of which are not that bad, you know. But you know, the basic idea, I think, should be clear. The intuition as to why it might help should be clear. The fact that it always works, you can either take on faith or read Gusfield's book. Any questions? Okay? The other thing that's true, that's complicated but interesting, is in fact you can build that failure function in linear time too. So we were saying, oh gee, let's spend a lot of time analyzing this pattern to build the failure function. In fact, by being clever, you can compute that failure function in linear time too. and it doesn't cost you a lot to build it. Okay? Any questions? Okay, again, see Gus Field's book for details. Okay? Now, if you read the literature, you'll see that there's lots of different ideas for failure functions. So that's one reason why the area is a little bit messy. There's lots of different variations of string matching depending on how clever you want your failure function to be. Okay? But basically, they don't have that much of a difference impact in practice in general. A second exact string matching algorithm that is very interesting is in fact, I think, the one that in general is probably considered the quote-unquote fastest in practice is something called the Boyer-Moore algorithm. And what's funny about it is it's going to match strings instead of, it's sort of like one of these alignment algorithms. We put the pattern, we put it up, overlap the text. We start comparing things. What Boyer-Moore is going to do is instead of comparing this pattern in the string from left to right, Boyer-Moore is going to start comparing the pattern from the string from the right end of the pattern in. Okay? So if we have the pattern that we have, again, A, B, C, D, A, B, C, D, text, I think I reversed the role of pattern and text. But what is going to happen when we look at the last character of the pattern and the nth character of the text? Here we see a mismatch on this position. What do we now know from that mismatch? Okay, obviously the pattern doesn't belong there. But how much can we slide the pattern over on this particular string? Can anyone give me an argument as to how far we can slide the pattern over without fear of making a mistake?
All over.
All over. Why is it all over? Well, I have analyzed, what do I now know? Oh, okay, if I know, you're right. Okay, if I know, again, I've reversed the role of pattern and text. Let's say that this is the pattern. If I know that, I'm getting a little bit confused. Okay, if I know that there is no, that the intuition here is that if I know that I have an E doesn't occur, that I have an E here and a D, okay, if I know that an E doesn't occur anywhere in my pattern, okay, I can slide the whole pattern over, right? In this particular case, I can take advantage of the fact that this mismatch and the fact that that character doesn't occur anywhere here, I can move the next place to put the pattern is N positions over. Does everybody sort of see that? Okay? Then in principle, if I have analyzed my pattern to know what the distribution of letters is in my pattern, if I have a character here that did not appear anywhere in my pattern, clearly I can throw the pattern all the way over. Okay? So what's interesting about this? In principle, I can now do matching in a string and a pattern without looking at all the characters in the text. Okay? It is possible that I have a pattern, a string of length N and a pattern of length M. After I analyze my pattern, if I get lucky, it might be the case that by looking only at every nth character of the text, I might be able to rule it out and say it doesn't exist, it doesn't exist, it doesn't exist, it doesn't exist. Okay? Let's say that we wanted to find out whether or not, the Bible exists in the human genome. Okay? Does the string representing the Bible occur anywhere in the human genome? Well, most people say no. And it's very easy to prove because there's going to be some letters that are not A, C, G, and T, right? The rightmost letter, I don't know what the last non-A, C, G, or T letter is in the Bible, but I'm pretty sure it's at the last position or the next to last position. If you actually use this algorithm, you could slide over by the entire length of the Bible on every character read, mismatch, mismatch, mismatch. So potentially you get sublinear pattern recognition. Does everybody sort of see that?
And everybody said that you can't hope for that in the Boyer-Moore algorithm, doing the comparison, in the Knuth-Morris-Pratt algorithm. Reading it from left to right, you can't ever hope to not look at everything in the pattern, in the text, at least once. Okay? Any questions? Okay?
So what is the idea of the Boyer-Moore algorithm, the basic idea? It is going to do the same thing that, that we did for for KMP. It's going to build up some failure tables. Okay, and in fact, it's going to use two different kinds of failure tables. One is, a failure table based on of size equal to the alphabet size that tells us how far to shift on a mismatch of every based on the text. So we're going to have a table that this is what that table is. It's going to let us know that if we see a character E, okay, knowing where the last E is that occurs in the pattern, or the fact that it doesn't occur at all, we can build a table that is proportional to the size of the alphabet to help us decide where to shift. If there was an E, the rightmost E in the text was, let's say, in the pattern was over here, we couldn't shift the pattern all the way over, but part of the way. So we can have one table built on the text character that we mismatched, and another table that is based by analyzing the length of the suffix that is matched, just like the KMP algorithm. So if we're in a situation where here's our text, here's our pattern, we have matched for M characters of the pattern, the K characters of the pattern before mismatching. We know that the mismatches here is going to be, the two things that we know are, what is the character we mismatch on in the text? And based on that, we can figure out where to slide the pattern. And we also know that we have matched a suffix of the pattern up to here. By analyzing the suffix, we can build a table to decide how much of a slide can we do based on that. And the bigger slide of the two is the one we can safely make, okay, without ever losing a pattern match. That's sort of, is the intuition sort of clear, not the details? Okay? Yeah. So there's two separate sources of potential information we now have. What is, we have analyzed the pattern offline and built a table just like the KMP table, or similar to the KMP table, knowing that at the, if we match the first, the last K characters of the pattern, based on knowing that the K characters of the right before us, okay, in the current pattern match are the same, based on knowing that this is ATATATAT, we can now figure out how much are we allowed to slide the pattern on a mismatch. That's one thing that's like the KMP table. The other thing that we know is that we can build up a table that is proportional to the size of the alphabet, okay, to tell us on this weird character position, how far can we slide, okay? And the bigger the slides of those two, since both of them, we're not going to make any mistakes if we slide it that much, the bigger of those two tells us how much we can slide the pattern. Okay? Any questions? Okay? So this is sort of a, this requires a certain intricacy and a certain detailed thing. And so again, if you go to Gus Field's books, you can learn a lot about these particular algorithms. Yes? How about you shift if you find the match, the answer is you don't shift at all. So the assumption goes as a shift. In our Boyer-Moore algorithm, when we match it, I'm using shift to describe the motion of the pattern. The pattern is eventually going to shift all the way to the right side of the string in the course of the execution of the algorithm, right? We are also going to, our attention, though, is going to shift to the left, is going to only look to the left. Okay?
So the basic algorithm is, plot the pattern down, start looking at the right, so long as it matches, keep looking to the left. As soon as we have a mismatch, slide the pattern over, okay? And also slide our attention over to the right end of that pattern, okay? So that's sort of the dance that is happening. But so long as things match, we're going to march left till the end of the pattern, at which point we pronounce a match. As soon as we have a mismatch, we're going to look at the two possible sources of how much can we shift, and slide the pattern as far over as we can safely, without neglecting, without losing a match if one exists. Okay, and then start searching again from there.
Yes.
But if I want to know the difference, find all occurrences of the pattern. Here I'm doing exact full pattern matching. The moment I have matched to the leftmost part of my pattern, okay, that, you know, then I know that I have completely matched it, and I know the locations of my pattern. So now I have to do something in my algorithm, okay? Can you print out the pattern or do what I want? And here it is, it's from here to here, okay? So you're right that once I have successfully matched the leftmost character of my pattern, I know I have a character pattern map, and I have to do something about it. Any questions? But then the question, what do I do on a pattern map, is actually interesting. How much time might this algorithm take if I try had a world where where I asked to report all possible solutions? Okay? I want to find all places where the pattern exists. How much time might this algorithm take? Yeah?
N.
Why is that? What would be an example of such a script?
If the pattern is a text of one letter,
the E is equal to. Exactly. So I suppose my text was E. Okay? What is the clue that my pattern was a smaller number of all E's? What is this algorithm going to do? It's going to align the pattern here saying, bingo, 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 yeah, we got a match. I spent M characters tests doing that. Now to find the next match, how much can I slide it over? Well, this might be an E, right? So I don't know anything. I might now have to report something there, yeah.
Isn't there a decision that you have to make about overlapping matches?
There's a decision you may want to make about whether things are interesting or not to you. Okay? So, typically, the question of whether overlapping matches are interesting to you is up to you. Okay? This algorithm will give you all matches, including overlapping matches. Okay? And you agree that in the case where we have to actually report a lot of matches, where there are, it matches lots of times, the worst case time might become quadratic. Now that is not true for Knuth Morris Pratt. Yeah? Well, the question is, what is it, if we're using this strategy, what do we know? Here we have matched from here, all F characters are E's. I now have to decide where do I slide my pattern over, without knowing what the next character is. Once I look at the next character, then, you know, that is slide over by one, now what you're saying is, knowing that I previously matched this, and I've now slid this over, can this help me find it the next time? In principle, you might be able to do some analysis of that situation to help you, but this is a relatively rare situation. If you're saying you build up a special algorithm for the case of all E's, okay? Well, that's reprocessing. That is reprocessing the pattern. But it's reprocessing the pattern as a function. It also has to take into account the last character that you have here. So to exploit that kind of reprocessing, you need to have a table that is proportional to the length of the pattern times the number of symbols in your alphabet. which starts to be a larger fable to handle a somewhat obscure situation. So if you expect a lot of occurrences to look for, you're better off with Knuth Morris Pratt. If you're expecting a few occurrences, you're better off with this, because you're searching from the right, and you might get lucky and rule it out without even looking at all the characters in the string. Okay? So which is better in practice depends something upon what kind of strings you're looking at. Okay? But in fact, you know, both of them are linear if you're not going to have too many, you know, if you're not going to, if the pattern does not exist too many times. Any questions? Okay? Fair enough. I'd like to show you one last exact string matching algorithm before I really dispatch the problem, and we'll talk about matching from that. So the last algorithm for exact matching that I'd like to talk about is to handle the third problem we hadn't talked about. We talked about suffix trees is good for fixed text variable patterns. We talked about Knuth Morris Pratt or Boyer Moore as good for variable text variable patterns. What about the dirty word case? What about the case where you have a fixed set of patterns and a lot but varying text? Okay? Again, this occurs, as I said, in dirty word search, in searching for motifs, in searching for patterns with wild cards. So one set of patterns that you might say is, gee, there's a DNA sequence I'm interested in. I want to know whenever ACG followed by one character followed by a T occurs. Okay? You know, maybe this is a don't care character in real life. I could represent this kind of a query as four different patterns, basically with all four possibilities there, and ask, you know, now I have multiple patterns, I want to analyze those multiple patterns so I know that whether in an input text, whether any of them occur anywhere. So does everybody sort of see why the problem of multiple patterns might come up? Okay, that should certainly be a reasonable thing. How might you answer them? The standard way to deal with multiple patterns uses ideas from automata theory. So if you're a computer science person, you probably sat through a course on automata theory. You did DFAs, you did NFAs, okay? This was good stuff. You may or may not have believed it at the time, okay? The standard way to do searching over a fixed set of patterns is to build a sort of automata or a little machine, or a graph if you wish, okay, to help show you where to go. So what we could do is build, let's say that we wanted to search for one pattern. The pattern here is nano. Okay, I want to look for texts which have the buzzword nano in it. Nanotechnology, nano integration, nano whatever. Okay? What I could do is build a automata or a graph where the vertices represent states. And there's a directed edge from one state back to another state. Okay? Okay? And I'm going to label my backwards edges with the total set of characters in the alphabet. So what am I going to do? What would be helpful in recognizing nano? Building a machine that will be helpful for recognizing if the word nano occurs in a text as it streams by. Originally, I know nothing about it. At the beginning of the text, I know nothing. If I look at the first character, there's one of two possibilities. It's either going to be an N, or it's going to be something else. If it's something else, it's not going to help me match nano at all, is it? Okay, so I'll keep looping back here until I get an N. Once I get an N, I now enter this state. Okay? If I get an A, I'll move on to the NA state. Okay, because now I know that I might need matching nano. If I got an N here, my last two characters were NN. If I'm matching nano, what might be nano starts to match from this N, right? So I can start to loop back over there. If I got anything else other than an N or an A, okay, I would loop back to the state of knowing nothing. When I got to the NAN state, if I got an N from the NAN state, that puts me in this new place. And A gets me from here to nana, I go back one spot,
My claim is I can build an optometer where I'll have an edge for every letter going out, telling me, given that I've matched this much so far, and given that the next character is this, where do I go? And by looking up in a table, it will tell me how far back in this optometer do I have to go to capture what I have seen so far. Okay? And by doing this, certain states are going to be important states, like the nano state. I want to know when I see a nano. Maybe I'll print it out or do something. Most of the states will be just intermediate states to help me do the computation. On each character I come in, I will know exactly where to go, right? Because there's going to be a state for every prefix that I've reached that is interesting. Based on my current state and the character I have seen, there'll be a table telling me what next state to go to. And so basically in time linear in the size of the text, I can search for all the patterns, okay, using this kind of an automata. Any questions? Okay, is that sort of clear or reasonable? Okay. So I claim all three of our exact pattern matching problems we now have reasonably good ways to solve. Starting next class, next week, we'll look at inexact matching. Okay? Thank you very much.